Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Hey, everybody. Hey, monkeys. Happy holidays. This episode, we talk to the delightful and lovely and very friendly and warm. I'm giving her a good intro because turns out she's actually a really nice person. You'll understand here in a minute what I'm talking about. Emmy-nominated actress Sharon Lawrence. You may know her best as Sylvia Sipowicz on the ABC drama series NYPD Blue, on which she was fantastic, and a whole bunch of other stuff. One of the most familiar faces on TV and in film, she currently is in the Lifetime movie Poinsettias for Christmas, or Poinsettias for Christmas. You can find that right now on My Lifetime On Demand. So come along with me, won't you, and talk with Sharon Lawrence. Here we go. We're going to start. We started. I'll introduce you a little bit later as a little preamble so I can talk about you when you're not here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's an interesting strategy.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'll assess.
Very modern.
I need this time to talk to assess what I want to say later.
Uh-huh, exactly. Right.
So anybody listening to this now knows that what I just said a few minutes ago about you, I determined all that. I distilled all the information from what we're doing right now. So
this is a time bend.
Be really interesting.
This is totally. Yeah. You're time traveling.
So
right here.
What I've planted in your head though is like, ooh, what is he going to say about me? I better be really nice in this conversation. Hi, Sharon Lawrence.
Hi, Larry.
How are you?
I'm really nice. That's what.
Well, we'll just see about that, won't we? Well, we'll see how the next few minutes goes.
Exactly. You'd be the judge of that.
Let's get out of the way right away because I'm hoping that whenever somebody's listening to this, it will be right around the time that they are going to see your Lifetime movie.
Oh, yeah.
Probably available on demand, and I assume will be repeated. And that is...
yeah.
There it is. Poinsettias for Christmas. Do you say poinsettias or poinsettias?
Isn't this an interesting debate? It's one that we had on set.
Seriously?
You bet, because I think it's a universal question. And my castmates, Bethany Joy Lenz and John Schneider and Marcus Rosner and our director, Christy Rowe Wolf, we all
I'm so glad
had this
you
conversation.
Had this conversation.
And Lauren London.
Yes.
We all think, how do you do it? And it's... there's no real hard, fast rule. I think if you're Southern like I am, I always grew up saying poinsettias.
We grew up in Texas, and I was going to say the exact
same
thing.
Yeah, we drop that extra syllable because it's French, and we can't figure it out.
Heck no, that's foreign. And we ain't got time for that. I mean, if we're dropping G's and stuff off
that's
of stuff,
right.
then we certainly don't have time for
no,
that us.
No, we don't waste. So you get a good poinsettia, and, and usually you'll get it for Christmas.
Well, now it sounds funny that you say poinsettia. Yeah, okay, anyway. However you pronounce it, let's just be fancy and say Poinsettias for Christmas, Lifetime. You want to tell us a little bit about the movie? Is it just a bunch of flowers? Is that what it's about
for two hours? Well, it's a little deeper than that. And as my friend Bethany Joy Lenz, I mentioned her name before, and I'll just call her Joy from here on out.
All
because
right.
that's not only is that what she goes by, but that is what she is. She's a good friend. We met on One Tree Hill years ago. And I'm such an admirer of her her work ethic and her talent and just the way she walks in the world. She's a lovely, lovely spirit. And
Nice. As
she says in one of the posts that she put on Instagram, is she says, I got to go save the farm. And that's really what happened. She has to save the farm. She has to save the poinsettias that her family, myself as her mom and John Schneider, who a lot of your listeners would know as Bo Duke, but
Right. Also
now as a contestant on Dancing with the Stars.
Correct.
Because he has just amazed everybody with his, well, not those of us that are in the musical theater world, because we know that that's where he started.
Yeah,
and he's got great skills in that
area. He's a song
area.
And dance man.
Exactly.
Yeah,
he is. And he's
done
proved
a whole
it to
bunch
the world.
Of stage stuff. Yeah.
And he's so much fun. We need her natural talent, natural horticulture talent that she is squandering because she's gone off to the big city to live her life, to chart her path. And that's a story that a lot of us can relate to. What happens when you are looking for something more, but you know that your gift was right there all along? I mean, on some level, it's what Dorothy was dealing with when she wanted to seek Oz.
Right.
And it's not just like there's no place like home. It's that you are integral to your home in so many ways. And if you have if you're a big part of it, you will always be a big part of it, whether you're absent or present. And so many of us come home on holidays and it can be complicated, but it can also be a great reminder of why we still mean so much to the place that we grew up in.
That's actually really interesting, because I think you and I can relate a little bit. You grew up, as you said, in the South in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. You were born in Charlotte.
Yeah,
I grew up in West Texas, and it was never one of those things where I was just dying to get out, but I knew I was going to leave. I just kind of had to. I came here for college and stayed basically on the West Coast with one little stint back in Texas, because radio, it drags you around all over the place. So it was never like I was dying to get out, you know, kick the dust of this, you know, town off my heels and move on to the big city. But that kind of dichotomy of it's home, but it's not a place that I gravitate back to that much. And yet I'm so glad I grew up there. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
I'm so glad I
had that upbringing and that experience.
And when I go home, I know that in my parents' mind, I'm still part of their household.
Mm-hmm.
Of course I am.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful thing.
Do you ever get relatives? Because to this day, I'm in my 50s, and I still have relatives ask me, so when y'all coming back to Texas? I don't think I'm coming back. I've lived out here longer than I've lived anywhere in my life, even where I grew up.
Right. And this movie deals with that, because she resists it, you know, understandably so. Again, it's about charting her path.
Right.
And the reason that poinsettias are important is because that's the family business, is they, and when you think about that too, I'm on a show called The Ranch. Well, I'm on and off again because I'm one of Sam Elliott's love interests, and it depends on what season they need me or not.
This is the Netflix show, right?
Yeah, right, okay. Right. And it's about a ranch, and I had interesting conversations with the producers, especially Ashton, about family farms, because that's really what I think drew Ashton to that. You know, his roots are in that world.
Mm-hmm.
And the family farm is so challenged, and there was a great documentary called Farmland that followed young farmers, I think four or five of them, and the big choices that they have in front of them, because the world in agriculture changes so fast, and some of those changes are based on economic forces that are market-driven and corporate.
Right.
But some of it is also climate and just what's happening when you're talking about growing things, whether it's produce or livestock.
Right.
And
even just the idea of the family business, mm-hmm. is a model that has deteriorated over time because of the lack of brick and mortar stores and you know, small businesses growing and passing things down. Also, you know, like we're talking about, kids move away now. It's just it seems like there are more and more kind of transient kids as they grow up and go, it's just easier to kind of be a global citizen. And so that family business model just seems to be disappearing quite a bit.
And
too.
Yet, I do think that it is in the back of so many, many minds of millennials, especially when you live in a town like we do, Los Angeles, that I've been here 25 years now, and I see and feel, maybe more importantly, how dense it is and what it would be like to live somewhere a little less populated, a little slower, not slower pace so much as not a demanding pace that you get to set a bit more. We have a place up in Idyllwild, which is about 2 hours away from Los Angeles, and it's up in a mountain town, and we really do use that as a way to slow down, because we, my husband and I, both know that we need it. But those people that go back to take care of aging parents, or to look for a place where maybe their school systems are more appealing to them. I think that's a story that you find all over the world.
Yeah.
And that's why this film resonates in ways that are very relatable. And you also get some fascinating information about poinsettias that you never knew. I mean, we are being factual about how they grow. There's a crisis.
Was there a poinsettia consultant on the set?
You bet
there
was. We were actually on a farm that grows poinsettias in Vancouver, Canada, where they do a lot of the Christmas films. Oftentimes have to be shot in the summer. That's a little inside industry secret. So when you see us all layered up,
pulling back the
curtain, we are hot. but
look for a sweaty Sharon Lawrence this year in poinsettias for Christmas.
But you need pine trees, so that's where you get them. And we were on a beautiful property, and this company, this family farm, grows for Home Depot.
So they know what they're doing.
Absolutely.
Wow. Okay. So what's? Can you give me one? We'll move on to other things, by the way. Can you give me one fact about poinsettias or poinsettias? That would just, like, blow me away. Go ahead. Bring it.
They don't live their life with red leaves
what?
The entire time.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, I don't think I've seen... You know what? You only... Because really, unless you're on a poinsettia farm, you don't really see their growth process. So
That's right.
So they're green? I'm assuming
they're green until they're not,
until they turn red.
And I mean, I thought that they, you know, that red was like a rose. You know, you think a rose comes up and it's when it opens, the leaves are the petals are the color that the rose is going to be. Not the case with poinsettias. And I'm just going to leave it at that, because that's where the crisis is.
Such a tease. Look at that. You are good.
Yeah.
All right. So there's that. We plugged that thing enough. you always have a lot going on. You just, one of the reasons we're talking is because you just were involved in the Gilda Awards and received
yes,
the Gilda
I did,
Award.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was quite an honor.
And that's a very special, there's a couple of things special about that. Of course, it's a cancer support group, actually, that is a part of that. And when we talk about Gilda, it's Gilda Radner, of course. And she must have been kind of a comedic presence in your life in terms of just being a fan of hers, right?
You bet.
I mean, you and I are of ages and grew up seeing this amazing woman. But as a woman and seeing somebody in that position and doing what she was doing, anytime I talk to female comedians who, you know, saw her and see her stuff, really impactful in terms of, oh, there's a woman doing characters and I could do that.
I never saw, although I've done a lot of comedy, I never saw myself in the sketch comedy world.
Right.
So I watched her rather than identified with her.
Right.
But what I certainly identify with is that she was a woman who faced something so not just mortally challenging, and I mean it literally, but in front of the world.
Right.
How public her condition, the ovarian cancer, became, and how vulnerable that seemed to make her in all of our eyes, and how moving it was to see her continue to smile and laugh and welcome the opportunity to still bring herself to the world that had fallen in love with her.
Right.
Even to the end. And what I learned from the cancer support communities of, they're global, actually. There are 175 chapters around the world. What I learned from this organization is Gilda's history and why she was able to continue to smile and do it publicly was because of a cancer support group that she found here in Southern California, specifically in Santa Monica. It was called the Wellness Center at that time. Mm-hmm. She was devastated. She was in sort of seclusion. She did not want to talk about her disease. She did not feel like laughing again.
Right.
But that place, going to that place that Gene Wilder, her husband, who we all also fell in love with even earlier with Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory,
sure,
the original, and her therapist, they're the ones that suggested that she go to this singular, unique place, which allowed her to be with other cancer patients and not feel like a fish in a bowl. And that is what changed her ability to say, I am still me. And that's what cancer support centers allow the patients and the families to do. Mm-hmm. Because it's not about the medical treatment. It's not about your prognosis or your therapy, your, you know, medical, clinical work. It's about how do we give the cancer patient a community to continue to thrive. And that, to me, is what one of the miracles of her life really is. She wanted this resource to be available to everybody. So she started what many people may know of as the Gilda's Club.
Right.
And in 2009, they joined forces with the Wellness Center here in Los Angeles and became the cancer support community. You'll find one, you know, you can just look at their website and find one near you, or you can support them too. That's what the awards are about. It's an evening that celebrates people who have been able to use their talents or their network to build support for this world of cancer. Survive, just people going through it. It's less a medical outreach than it is, like I said, more for mental health.
Right.
And they'll provide things like nutritional counseling and massage therapies and Zumba classes. And the awardees this year were myself for the work that I've done with a couple of fundraising events that are shows. Those of us who can sing and dance on stage to raise money for various cancer support groups. And the other recipient was Lisa DeLito, who has done a beautiful documentary about Gilda called Love Gilda.
It's
which
so
we,
good.
Yeah, we saw some of the footage from it, and it's wonderful because it really captures that period of her life. Not just the early days, because she was documenting everything. Gilda was.
Yeah.
She was her own documentarian, but even including these tough times.
It's been proven over the years that, you know, there are medical treatments, and then there are these, you know, there is so much data that says quality of life improves just because you have support, because you have a more of a positive outlook, that you know, the mind can do so much good for your body in fighting mm-hmm. certain illnesses, or it just extending your life in a way that at least allows you to feel like you're not alone, and that you know, share this with other people, and that can just do wonders to.
That's right.
Just
and it's about being able to talk to the person sitting next to you who's going through the same thing, who says, you know what, it's really a drag to have you know, the bone pain that you have with mm-hmm. certain chemotherapies. How did you deal with it?
Right.
Rather, you can't necessarily talk to your spouse about that. They can't understand.
Yeah.
But somebody who's going through it, we know tribes are important. And that's what this mm-hmm. allows
right.
for, is
right.
a tribe.
Is there a website people can check out that you can send people to? Or
Yes. CSCLA.org is the one locally.
Great.
Because the LA stands for Los Angeles.
Right. But there's certainly going to be something similar in your area if you check that out.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Right.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Very nice. So can we talk a little bit about your history? We talked about North Carolina, how you lived there up through college.
I did. I graduated from UNC Chapel Hill. I'm a Tar Heel. Yeah. And for 3 years, very recently, I was the General Alumni Association representative for the West Coast alums. And I won the distinguished. I was given the Distinguished Young Alumni Award back in 2001. And it really tied me to the university in a great way because I was going back every quarter. And it's wonderful for me to see how the departments that I spent my time in, which was the journalism school, which is a very high level school. We're ranked right up there with, you know, Columbia and Northwestern. And also the theater department is great. That is a place that I, although my degree was not in theater because I was just very pragmatic and didn't really think about making a living.
Yeah, journalism.
This way. My father is a journalist.
Okay.
Yeah. Newscaster. News ran the news division for 2 big CBS affiliates in North Carolina. The Southeast is really has always been very strong with CBS network, and he was at BTV in Charlotte and RAL in Raleigh for 40 years combined, I guess.
Okay.
And like I said, he was not just a reporter, not just on air, but also ran a news division. He opened up a satellite office in Fayetteville on the military base there for Desert Storm 1. And he also was their technology reporter for WRAL in the Research Triangle Park, where there's a lot of major tech development because of the universities, Duke State, NC State, Carolina, et cetera, North Carolina, AT&T. And he was an early adapter of a lot of those. I think the understanding that the web was the future.
Yeah. So you wanted to follow in his footsteps a bit? And
I did, yeah.
On camera, do that?
Yeah, that was always something I knew that I was comfortable at. Don't ask me to do long division. Now, the long division I can do. Fractions scare me.
Yeah, yeah.
But I have always been comfortable in speaking in public doing the investigative stuff really would have interested me. And frankly, you'll find a lot of crossover with people that have pursued acting and journalism. And it's not because they're the same. They are not the same. But they do both require tenacity and curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have those qualities to do either one of those jobs well.
Well, I can definitely see where the skills as a journalist I don't know that everybody, you know, shares that in the acting world, but I can certainly see from the standpoint of digging into a character, like even if you're building your own, you know, kind of crafting your own story along with the script that's going on, maybe a more analytical approach than necessarily purely instinctive approach. And
acting you have to be curious.
Combination of two of those.
You do. You have to work well with people.
Yeah.
You have to know that you will have more questions the further that you dive.
Yeah.
Actor,
I can see you on set now.
Do.
I can see you on set now approaching the director with like the little pad in your hand and going, I have a few questions for you. And just grilling them on what your character's motivation is. You might be one of those. Really digging.
Well, I do like the process of rehearsing and pulling it apart.
Yeah.
And television doesn't allow you that much time to do that.
Right.
So you have to be very self-sufficient in television. Mm-hmm. But film and theater do allow for it.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons that I do a play every year. I have to satisfy that.
Yeah, you're on stage a lot here in L.A.
Yeah.
And have been for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, your name is always popping up on Center Theater Group and a bunch of other places.
Right.
I know I've seen you do a bunch of
all
stuff.
All of them.
Where was the little sharp turn where you got a journalism degree? And what happened?
Well, it happened at Carolina.
Okay.
I mean, honestly, it
started
did.
Started edging into theater a little bit?
Yeah, and I was on stage a lot there. And because they had a professional rep company that employed not just the, and by employed, I mean the broad sense of the word, that they used the graduate students on their their Equity Lort C, which is just a classification for the size of theater and the pay rate.
Mm-hmm.
They used the grad students for that, and they jobbed in actors from New York and directors from New York.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was an undergrad student, but I got cast in the production, so I could talk to people that were making a living at it. And it didn't seem so far away. It didn't seem out of reach.
Yeah.
And then I went to do summer stock because I was enjoying the work on stage. And again, I was working with people in New York. And I, because they were unbiased and said, you could do this. You could hang. You could compete, because that is what it comes down to.
Sure.
If you're going to make a living at it, it doesn't have to be your vocation for it to be satisfying. And I think too many times people miss that understanding that it's a calling. It doesn't have to be a career.
Right.
And when you find a place to do it, it can be very satisfying. And it doesn't have to come with the paycheck for that satisfaction to happen.
Yeah. I mean, you and I probably both know a lot of actors in this town who are supremely talented and, you know, have been working really hard for a long time and haven't necessarily broken through to a level where they can make a living as an actor, but they continue to do it because it is just a love that they have. They'll do a play at any size theater. They'll be
That's
a part
right.
of a local company. They'll say yes to as many things as they can and do great work, and that satisfies them. And that's a good thing. I mean, that should be everybody's
exactly.
you know, way they approach their work. And mm-hmm. you don't see enough people who actually really enjoy their job that much.
Right. And the converse is true also, that just because you're paid doesn't mean that you're happy.
No.
Doing it.
Yeah.
So I have always seen that balance. My father is a wonderful actor, and he acted in some really great theaters. I say great theaters because that's where I learned about theater, was in Charlotte, North Carolina, watching him mm-hmm. at the Met Museum. Anybody that knows that theater knows this is it's a high level theater, because they set their standards high, and also because North Carolina is very committed to the arts. Our public school system, which I grew up in, always funded because they valued the performing arts.
Yeah.
So you had people that had grown up developing those skills.
Yeah.
And whether or not they made a living at it didn't mean that they were not actually proficient and even, you know, excelling in their art. The same is true in Raleigh, a theater that I helped start over 30 years ago now with an actor that a lot of people will know from musical theater, Terrence Mann. He was the original Javert in Les Mis. He was the original Beast in Beauty and the Beast. He was the original Rum Tum Tugger in Cats. And he had a really strong North Carolina connection because he went to the North Carolina School of the Arts. And we started a musical theater that does really, really high level productions. I mean, the people that come down are Broadway performers yeah. and directors and designers. And another theater there, Theater Raleigh, it was started by a gal who was a little kid in those productions of the theater we started. And now, after years in New York, she's come back to create an even more intimate version of that. So I know that the people that come here to make a living can often lose their joy in it because
of the business
yeah,
side of it and how
yeah.
crushing that can be.
Right.
And yeah, it's tough. Yeah. My, you know, I became well aware of, by the way, I don't know how much you're getting paid by the North Carolina Arts Foundation or whatever, but you're doing a great job.
Not a dime.
No, I became very aware of when my son was pursuing acting and auditioning for colleges, and North Carolina schools kept popping up as, you know, highly touted for
yes.
places to go. He didn't choose one of those. He went to BU, but he had to do that East Coast thing. But I'd be very aware of, oh, there's a real commitment. And also just kind of seeing the alumni that has come out of some mm-hmm. of those schools, it's mm-hmm. it's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So, anyway. So, they owe you a little something now.
Well, all I'm doing is paying back the foundation that they gave me. They
yeah.
really did.
Yeah.
And that's another thing. You know, we're talking about what it means to go home. There's a part of me that thinks, that would be very satisfying is to get to work with them again. And I have to make that more of a priority because I've had opportunities that I just couldn't say yes to because it's so far away. And yet I don't want to ignore the time passing and knowing that it will be a good place to go back and use the tenderness that I have for that place in a very pragmatic way, a real way, meaningful.
Now, you did make the leap from North Carolina, and you got some Broadway experience, like really early on.
You had
to pound the pavement for a while.
You bet I did.
But you got in some pretty high profile shows right away, But you made the move out here fairly quickly after that, didn't
you?
Well,
I worked my way up through the chorus. The reason that I think that it's valuable to mention is because I know that one of the struggles for young people now coming into our business is that they don't often get a chance to develop their skills and their understanding of the culture around the world of entertainment. And they don't get to find out whether or not they have the spirit for it, because it isn't just talent. It is, do you have a gypsy soul? Because you're required to move around for this work. It just is the nature of it. If you want to have a long career, like I'm leaving right after this holiday to go shoot a new series in New Orleans, because that's where it is.
Yeah.
And the good news is I can sleep in hotel rooms just fine, but not everybody can. And I got to know that I am a gypsy, because I was working my way up through the chorus and tours that came back to Broadway. They were good, solid, classic shows that allowed for long runs because they were proven. It was Cabaret and Zorba, the Greek, and Fiddler on the Roof, and shows that were time tested. So I had the luxury of knowing what it's like to do a long run in a show. And that's a certain skill or a certain experience that you can only get with a show that's a hit.
So
after about 8 years in New York doing that and waiting tables in between that time and taking dance classes and taking acting classes and paying $100 for a voice lesson, which was, a lot of money back then. It's a lot of money now. It was a lot of money then.
Yeah.
Knowing that I was sort of giving myself my own grad school is what made me realize that I'm investing in this long term. There was... I always knew I could go home if I needed to. And by that, I mean, take that journalism degree and find a way to use that that education, that public school, four-year college.
Did you ever get to that point where you gave yourself a deadline and you're like, if I don't, get to this certain point, or was it just never in doubt for you? It was.
I did give myself a deadline. Yeah. I gave myself 5 years.
Okay. From
when I graduated from Carolina.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And it worked within that five-year period.
Yeah.
So after 8 years of that world and having the experience of being on Broadway and, I had also done big roles in big shows at the theater that I helped start, so I knew what it was like to carry a show. I realized that not only it had a great range of experience, but I understood what it meant to do the same story 8 times a week for 2 years at a time.
Right.
But I also was deprived of watching television because I was on the road and I was working at night, right? That's
right.
When the shows are.
Right.
Well, when VCRs, which for those of you who are too young to know what that is, it's called a video
cassette
recorder.
Yeah.
I could finally watch television because I could record it. And by that time, when I left for college, shows like Dynasty were on, and I never really saw myself that way. That wasn't my image of the kind of characters that I would play. Not glamorous, fancy, those kind of women. I just didn't see it.
Primetime soap operas, which became quite popular.
And driven by that kind of power woman.
Right.
Right? So when I could watch television, things had shifted a bit, and it was the shows that were on were 30-something, mm-hmm. China Beach, mm-hmm. L.A. Law. They were about women that were and characters and worlds that were more relatable to me, even though one was about nurses in Korea, that was China Beach, and
right.
one was about lawyers, which I didn't really know that much about. But just the story seemed, and the characters touched me more.
Right.
And I finally was interested in television. It had never been something that I had considered. And that's why I said, all right, I'm going to go try this. And yeah. I packed up a used car that my dad helped me buy. And I drove cross country. And I knew two people, a gal that I'd waited tables with here, who I'm still really close to, who's one of the best acting coaches in Los Angeles now. Oh, well, actually, she's all over the place. Her name is Lee Kilton Smith, and she's great. And we waited tables together at a place called Curtain Up in New York and had stayed friends. And then a guy that I was dating, and that came out. So I started from scratch, really.
Wow.
But I was kind of right on time because I was 30 and I knew how to work and I knew how to.
Were you good
discipline.
At auditioning?
Yeah, I was good at auditioning.
That didn't intimidate you?
No.
Okay.
Because I also knew how to learn lines, and I had been on stage and been in front of people. And that's what I mean about working my way up. A mm-hmm. lot of people get thrown into opportunities way before they have the structural grid work built into their mind. And even to know how to control their nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have a nervous system. I'm not saying we're all nervous people. But we all respond to whatever stimulus is happening around us. And we need, as actors, our job is to become private in public. So when you're playing a character, you have to find a way to be in your private world while there's a camera crew
right.
around you.
Right. You have to project vulnerability or certain emotions that... you're in control of.
You have to live in imaginary circumstances.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
You have to be
That's
real
really
in imaginary circumstances.
Right.
And there's so many things that are coming at you that are not imaginary, like the airplane that just flew overhead if you're doing an exterior shot in the middle of a take and they cut and you have to rewind, find your concentration again, and find that privacy again that will allow you to stay concentrated.
Mm-hmm.
When there are a lot of things that are going to distract you.
How difficult was it for you to transition from being, you know, you did the work and you had the structure and you worked your way up on from a stage perspective, but how difficult was it for you to adjust to the life of being on a set where
yeah,
there is
question.
A camera in your face and there are multiple takes and,
well,
and it's a very
mm-hmm.
different process.
I did some student films while I was still in New York
mm-hmm.
doing stage, and
so
that helped me
you.
Understand what it meant to have that clapboard in and pick a scene up from the middle
right.
rather than, you know, from the begin. Tell you're not telling
doing
a story from the beginning.
Completely out of sequence, right? Yeah.
And to know that there are camera crew members that are busy doing their job. That's not the audience. And, you know, on a stage, in a stage environment, everybody agrees at one moment in time when the curtain goes up that everyone's concentrating on the same thing. That's not the way it is on a film set.
Right.
It's very disjointed. But that's the process. I'm not complaining about it. That's just what it is.
Just
it also
is, yeah.
allows for a beautiful product at the end. I did have to learn how to manage what it takes for me to peak at a different time. When you're doing a play, your biorhythm develops over the rehearsal process and then over the process of tech, that your the technical rehearsals, you start to shift over from your daytime rehearsals into your nighttime calls that mean that, okay, I'm going to stay up a little later and I sleep in a little later so that I'm peaking
right.
when I'm supposed to. You don't have that luxury in film or television.
Yeah.
Maybe sitcom because the schedules are a little more consistent, but you know, I knew about Dynasty. I had seen it, but I never related to it. Well, now I'm on it. I'm on the reboot, which is funny,
right.
playing one of those evil women.
On the CW.
And on the CW, yeah. And that shoots in Atlanta, so I'm having to fly
right.
and adjust to the time zone.
Mm-hmm.
And also we start on Mondays at 5 a.m. if you're a woman. 5 a.m. is a typical call for the women to get in hair and makeup.
Yeah.
And you are always adjusting yourself, your the way you eat, how you try to sleep in these hotel rooms, what your workout schedule can be. So it's a lot of behind the scenes stuff that people don't really think about when they're watching it. But you have to if you're the one who's the product and you become part of the equipment that it takes to. And we're not equipment. We're not machines. So it's our job to learn what we must do to manage well.
Still learning, it sounds like.
Oh,
like,
all the time.
You've never stopped having to figure out how to, you know, adjust
all
your schedule or deal with the material. Or here you are doing Dynasty at a time in your life where years ago you were going, well, that's not my thing. It's so interesting that and you found a way for that to be your thing. Probably the hair helps, right? How big is the hair? I haven't seen you on Dynasty yet.
I love that you know that. The hair is not really big. What was fun for me, I usually never am called on to do this, but I had to wear my hair with a visor because I had to play tennis. And my husband, I'm not a tennis player, but my husband is. And he taught me when we met. You know, he taught me the strokes, and because I was a dancer, he knew that I could do the footwork, but I'm not competitive.
Right.
I don't care about winning. Just not my thing. Probably because I spent so much time in a subjective endeavor, like the arts. It's subjective. And even when you don't get a role, I don't think of it as a win or a loss, because I know that it's about what fits for the story,
yeah.
Which isn't going to work for, and not everybody fits every story.
Right.
But tennis, you have to practice to be able to win. And I'm just not that interested.
Yeah.
But I had to go out and look like I was a fierce tennis player. And damned if I didn't, man. He taught me well. I look like I'm a real player because I know how to hit.
Yeah.
But so I had to wear my hair up in a visor. And you know, it was just more like my everyday, not everyday Sharon style, but more Sharon style. Now, this show that I'm doing for YouTube, set in the 90s, they want the model, the pictures they've shown me for the look is Ivanka Trump. So I'm going to have
90s era Ivanka?
90s, 1991. Big shoulder pads.
Yeah.
We'll have to wear masks while
or
I'm
Ivana.
In here in makeup. Ivanka. You're right. Ivana.
Right. Yeah,
Ivana.
Yeah, yeah.
For all the hairspray. There'll be a lot of hairspray involved.
See? Still learning. Learning how to be competitive. Probably learning how to wear a visor. How many times have you worn a visor in your life, for crying out loud?
Yeah. I'm in an orange jumpsuit this week, too, because I'm a criminal in Criminal Minds, which is going to be fun. I always like that. I've worn jumpsuits on a couple of shows, like Desperate Housewives.
Yeah.
What was the other one that I wore a prison suit on? Oh, yeah, Law and Order. And that's got to be one of my favorite costumes because it's so comfortable.
Listen to you just talking about, talking about being a working actor and the ability to, you have been on certain things, you know, for long term. Of course, NYPD Blue is probably the thing that so many people talk to you about.
Right,
I saw actually a lot of people talking to you around the time of Stephen Bochco's death, and you had some amazing stuff to say about him, and we can dig into that. But you've been a working actor. I mean, steadily a working actor. That's a hard thing to do. Talk about a gypsy lifestyle. You just listed off like a handful of shows right there. If you look at Sharon Lawrence's IMDb, you will glaze over at some point because it's going to be all night reading to see all the different things you've done.
Well, you've been around that as long as I have. That was when they were also... Well, now I think as an actor, just imagine how many more opportunities there are, even than when I started.
Just because the amount of content that's being produced, especially television. Yeah,
really exciting. And I feel that as a woman, I ran Women in Films Foundation for years.
Right.
And our mission was to balance things out. And the beginnings of that really started with the executive positions. That's where Women in Film was finding their power early on, in the corporate aspect or the executive level. I shouldn't say corporate because a lot of these were independent studios and of course, the agency, and the networks. And now it's also about the content creators. And I'm on the advisory board of a group called We for She, which only focuses on female television writers and directors. That's all we serve. And it's great to see how we can influence the understanding about what it takes to balance this industry.
Yeah, there are some really big strides being made, largely due to the fact that there is more content out there. But, you know, producers and casting people and also female showrunners, I mean, Shonda Rhimes just has done an amazing job at, creating a beachhead for herself and also bringing in talent and mature talent. You've got Viola Davis, is Robin Wright doing her work on House of Cards. What else was I?
Ryan Murphy's World. He's got a big initiative that he is fulfilling so beautifully with. He wanted half of his directors to be women,
right.
And they are.
Writing staffs filled with women and so much more diversity than before. Oh, I was Julia Roberts just doing this show with Sam Esmail, Homecoming, which is a phenomenal work. And, but Julia Roberts is in her, 50s now? Is she in her early 50s?
Maybe.
And, there is a point at which I think there was a time, certainly, where if you had thought about being a woman and being an actor in your 50s, that you were just going to have to start to wind it down. And I'm sure there is still some consideration of that, but there is so much opportunity, it seems now, for a wide range of ages and faces, and it even if not all the TV is that good, I think a new golden age of TV is appropriate because it's opening up for so much different kinds of talent to create and to write and to act and to tell their stories.
And I'm a big audience member.
Yeah.
I don't want to say I'm a big. That's not what I mean. I'm a rabid audience. I watch a lot. And what I want to see has changed. So I'm glad. I'm really grateful that people are creating television.
Yeah, as a consumer.
As
somebody who wants to really be challenged and see entertaining. I mean, I love the fact that I don't have to sit down and go, let's go watch fill in the blank of a movie I've seen before. It's like, no, there are new episodes of something really interesting available all the time. And if it's good, it really organically, rises to the top. I mean, I know there's a lot of stuff out there, but this is kind of the great thing is that people doing really good work, it gets noticed and it hangs around a little bit and goes viral and word spreads and it becomes this hit at a level that is very different now in terms of what a hit means. Can we talk about NYPD Blue a little bit? Because that was, it doesn't seem that long ago to me. When I start doing the math, it kind of freaks me out. But it still was an era that you were basically talking three or four major networks
at the time.
And that was a groundbreaking show. It was in the mold of the kinds of things that you had talked about, that you had discovered. I remember, when I had my VCR, I was recording things like Hill Street Blues and St. Elsewhere, and then, kind of those grounded in reality shows that I really responded to, and then it extended into the 90s with L.A. Law, and, Bochco was, doing stuff that was blowing people away. Mm-hmm. That show in particular, I remember thinking, this is a game changer. And it must have felt that way to you as an actor to say, we're doing this on TV? We're actually exploring these kind of characters? We're digging this deep on television. And now it seems somewhat standard to dig a little deeper, but for network TV, that must have been a phenomenal feeling.
Yes, because I think because we knew we were in the hands of somebody that was so masterful, Bochco and David Milch.
Right.
And I think you cannot underestimate what it meant for that network, for ABC and Bob Iger and those people that were running it and Ted Harbor to take the chance to be willing to stand up for a show that was going to challenge the status quo. And in the face of the pushback, which was happening in the early 90s from the conservative right, the right that was growing, there was a guy named Reverend Wildman.
I remember.
Who used the media to voice his disdain for what he believed was degrading. And he probably never, I don't know whether he did never, whether he ever watched the show or not, but our response, certainly mine, was that the show has such humanity that whatever the disapproval of these precepts of what was acceptable and unacceptable, people needed to decide for themselves. Mm-hmm. They had to watch for themselves to see if this was in bad taste, if it was smut, or if it was filled with an unassuming grace, the way these characters and their tenderness,
right,
in the face of a tough world of criminals and the criminal justice system, and
but you were seeing real people go through real things. Yeah. I mean, that's the beauty of art like that, is that it may be in the scenario of something that you don't know, like being a cop and prosecuting criminals and chasing down, but they were still human beings, and we get to see that side of them. And that's
and
where
we
have the entry point to relate to them,
right,
even in their kind of...
And the fulcrums for those shows, particularly Sipowicz, because he was the constant.
Yeah.
He was a flawed human, but everybody knew he was a good human.
Right.
And that's the difference, because there is certainly storytelling that just glorifies malevolence. And that I object more to than certainly nudity or bad language, because you can tell what the energy is behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's like Stephen Bochco and David Milch were honoring, it is the evolution, the spiritual evolution of someone who faces the worst of humanity and still manages to ascend beyond it, beyond his own addiction, beyond his own temper, beyond his own losses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Sipowicz became, is somebody who rises to the better angels. And these guys that were telling these stories, that's what they loved. That's why Deadwood is so interesting. That's why, right? And
don't
isn't it
even
great
get
it's
me, coming
can back?
Can we talk for an hour about Deadwood now? That's great. I mean, I can't be any more eloquent than you just were about that. I hope that people who maybe were too young to have watched that show get a chance to go back. I would imagine NYPD Blue holds up.
It does.
Even for today's audiences.
I hear from people all the time who are rewatching it. I think it is available on a streaming service now. I can't tell you which one, because there were strange ones that I didn't even know about, like Heroes and Icons. That network came about and was running it. But I think there are other ways. You can get it.
I think NBC's On Demand app allows you to. Mm-hmm. It was NBC. No, it was ABC. NYPD.
But it was a property of 20th Century
20th
Fox.
Century
so
Fox.
That may be
right.
Where the library is.
It's probably on your Hulu somewhere.
But that's that's the way you'll get to know Stephen Bochco.
Yeah.
And that and his book, will tell you. He was very candid in his book about what it was like to be the kind of writer and impresario and nurturing talent. So if somebody wants to learn about how to be more than a one man band, read how Stephen Bochco did it. How he found how to build a team and build the relationships with the networks that I was just telling you about to make them want to stand up and with him in the face of a cultural pushback.
Pushback, yeah. And create one of the timeless series. I mean, that thing is just incredible.
And what, it ran for 12 seasons? You know, I mean, think about that. Yeah. That just, yeah.
And after, I mean, spoiler alert, some main characters don't stay around very long. I'm just saying. But yeah. Zipowitz, he's there for a bit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sharon, I could feel like I could talk to you forever, and you probably.
Oh, is that all me?
You probably were feeling. Yeah, this
oh
is
my God.
This is all your work,
you
all the work you've done. No, this is just actually a sampling. I mean, it goes back.
Wow.
This TV.
We're looking
and film.
At pages and pages of things.
Yeah, I mean,
isn't
just,
that something?
Yeah, I mean.
Well, I'll be.
Monk, Desperate Housewives,
yeah,
Boston
I'm
Legal.
Reunited with on Monk. I played Ted Levine, who is the captain, the detective captain. I played his girlfriend on that, and now I'm reunited with him in this series with Kirsten Dunst that George Clooney and his company are producing. So that's exciting. That's fun for me to be able to go back and work with Ted. Yeah. I've gotten to that point where I'm circling back around to husbands. I ran into Tim Matheson the other night at dinner. And, you know, we realize we've been husband and wife. We've been fiancés, werewolves together. I mean, so it's interesting.
Oh, that's
just
hilarious.
Yeah. After decades, you.
That's awesome.
It's like folk dancing. You circle back around to your partner.
Yeah, you've got a feature you're shooting, or have?
Yeah, a couple of features.
The Lost
Husband,
Josh
The Lost
Duhamel.
Husband I just did with Leslie Bibb and Josh Duhamel and Nora Dunn. And then I did another feature called Killing Eleanor with my dear friend Annika Marks, who stars and wrote at, but also Jane Kaczmarek and Betsy Brandt.
Oh, man.
And Tom Sadowski.
You're back on Shameless next year.
Yeah, yeah.
We mentioned Dynasty on the CW. Good Lord. How did you fit me in? Why would you fit me in?
It's a holiday week.
Oh, okay, good. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy holidays.
To you. Yeah.
Poinsettias for Christmas. Or poinsettias for Christmas, depending on where y'all from.
Christmas is always produced. I mean, Christmas is always pronounced the same way, though, right? Let's not change that. Christmases.
It's the Mary that it gets. Murray. You're awesome. I think I'm
so
going to do
there.
A very nice intro because you have been nice.
Oh, wow. I've forgotten about the fact that, yeah, this was going to happen. Yeah,
yeah,
you were going to.
Unless it turns ugly in the next 30
graded.
Seconds. Okay, here's where I grade you because I've kept you too long. This is the lightning round. Quick questions, quick answers. First thought, favorite stage play all time.
That I did or watched?
Just any.
Well, I just saw one that will blow you away. A Christmas Carol, a one-man show by Tony winner Jefferson Mays at the Geffen Playhouse. It was, I mean, I've seen a lot of things, but that one, I'll never forget.
Local in Los Angeles, and people are raving about that.
Oh, my God.
If you were forced up on a karaoke stage, your go-to song would be?
Come
on.
Hit me with your best shot.
Oh, Pat Benatar.
Yeah, nice. No,
I could see you doing
right,
that.
Right out, yeah.
Okay, now, sing a line from that. No, I'm kidding.
Well, you're a real tough cookie with a long history.
Oh,
okay,
man.
That's one line.
Oh,
you got it.
Damn. Oh, wow, you threw me off my game.
What's your karaoke
song?
I'm
not really sure how I could react to that.
What's your karaoke
song? It was Sweet Caroline before that became kind of standard, but the one I actually like to pull out, depending on the audience, is I Think I Love You from the Partridge Family.
Oh, my God. How sweet.
If
that's
the audience
lovely.
Is old enough, you know, I have to scan them first, and otherwise then I'd do something stupid like a low-octave version of Like a Virgin by Madonna, which gets big laughs, and I don't have to sing it well.
Because neither did she.
Oh, ooh. Hot take on Madonna.
She didn't have, notes.
I'm not going to defend
it's
that.
It's three whole notes,
no,
right?
Exactly.
Right.
Okay. I forgot what my other questions were. The Pat Benatar singing really threw me off.
She was a great singer. She's a great singer. Yeah.
Final question. I am legally and contractually obligated to ask this question from my overlords. Have you ever worked with a monkey? And if you haven't, would you be willing to? So first part first.
Well, you know, I've got all those pages. I don't want to. I mean, hey, I've worked with some really hairy men, but
yeah, have I worked with a monkey? Name those.
No. I was asking for that. no, I don't think I've worked with a monkey. Would I be willing to? I would love to have worked with the Monkees back in the day. They were my first crush.
Oh, who was your favorite?
Well, I started out with Peter, actually. I mean, I love Davey, but Peter Tork was. I can't explain it.
Oh,
I guess the bowl haircut. I don't know why. Maybe I was just. I was deciding I liked character men.
That's so funny. You're a Peter gal. Well, that just sounds terrible. At least that was a terrible way to end this podcast. Sharon Lawrence is a Peter gal.
Well,
the end.
I'd rather work with a monkey than be known as a Peter gal. I want to know who your overlords are that are interested in my monkey business.
It's just the required questions. I don't work for anybody. I just like to ask the monkey question.
Okay.
Sharon, you are a delight. I hope I can drag you back in again when you have 19 other things to talk about that you're doing.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
You know, we can just talk about
or
you
we
know,
could just sing our
world.
We could just sing our favorite karaoke tunes. All right. We're going to go now.
Thank you, Larry.
Get a monkey. Get a monkey!